Hi everyone, Davis Hinoptorp here from the Tribuna Podcast. Happy New Year, and we hope you guys had a nice, relaxing holiday season. Before we get started on the podcast, I just wanted to tell you guys up front that this podcast was actually recorded on Monday, but due to some logistical reasons, we weren't able to publish it until Wednesday. So things might be a little bit outdated, especially regarding rumors surrounding Timo Werner. So I apologize, but I hope you still enjoy the show. Davis Hinoptorp here with Jonathan Harding and Matt Ford back in 2019. And in the first match day in the return of the Bundesliga, you guessed it, the big teams won. Dortmund beat Leipzig, Bayern Munich beat Hoffenheim, and Matt Ford was also in Leverkusen to catch the Gladbach-Leverkusen game. But let's start this week in Leipzig. So Dortmund edged out a 1-0 victory in Leipzig. It was a maybe not the most spectacular game without Marco Reus on the field, but at the same time, it was a big result for Dortmund, a team that is obviously has a great chance to win the title. Jonathan, we watched this game together. Axel Witsel, I think, grabbed all the headlines, but Roman Bürki was also pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think it was a defensive display that deserves a lot more credit. I mean, you're right to point out Axel Witsel's performance. A lot was said about him being a leader in midfield, very dynamic performance in all field, in all areas of play. But I think defensively was where Dortmund really won this game. I think about previous games where Dortmund would have drawn this or maybe even lost it, dropped points, and people would say, oh, you know, that's classic Dortmund showing that weakness. Just when Bayern had put the pressure on, they didn't have an answer. But I thought defensively, they were outstanding, and that's considering Akanji was out.
And Julian Weigl was playing
and Julian Weigl played in centre-back like a veteran. It was like watching Tony Adams. You know, he was like jumping around, blocking balls, sliding tackles, perfection.
It was his second game in a row in that position, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He played there against Gladbach, so he is well on his way to becoming a fully-fledged centre-back.
I love it. I mean, and Favre was very calm. He said, you know, don't worry, our centre-backs will work. You know, and the thing about Weigl is lots of criticism about him only ever doing the sideways passing and not being very direct. But that works pretty perfectly as a centre-back in that situation because his passing is excellent. So just put him in there. He can obviously tackle. But it's been, I think his story in this situation is really interesting because this is a player that was supposed to be leaving, you know, talk about him being sold in the summer, Tuchel being interested in him, going to Paris.
A lot of talking even in January that he was going to leave.
And he didn't go, isn't going. Now he's staying, fought back from fitness, wasn't really in favour under Favre because of the fact that he wasn't very direct in the passing in midfield and Dahoud is a lot more dynamic. All of these things playing against him, and you think that Julian Weigl's time at Dortmund is over, and he comes back and he's sensational. You know, and a combination of him and Bürki, who, quite frankly, yeah, he had one moment where it was a little bit sketchy, but other than that, he's had such a steady improvement over the years in terms of, over the last year even, in terms of how he's played shot-stopping-wise, that it's such a refreshing sight, or a new way to look at this Dortmund side, that they were able to go to Leipzig and win off the back of a defensive performance. That was what really got me.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, Matt, it was pretty impressive though, because I mean, Dortmund, I think, on away from home in recent seasons too, just wouldn't win a game like that. They maybe would come up with a draw. Was there anything in particular that you saw in Dortmund, with, especially without Reus in a defense, that stuck out to you?
Well, yeah, the resilience to go there and actually get 3 points. Like you said, third time they've been there, they lost the first one 1-0. The second one was 1-1, a relatively unspectacular affair. This time, given the last-minute injury to Reus, given the fact that Weigl was going to be starting at centre-back, I didn't see them getting anything out of that game. So, yeah, surprised in the end, and I think it says a lot. I think it's exactly the sort of game, you know, they've fought it out the hard way in the end, and come the end of the season, if they are to hold on, I've got 16 games to go, that's where you're going to look back and say that's exactly where this title was won in games like that. Yeah, without taking too much away from Dortmund, I think John's right to point out how stable they were at the back, how it was a victory for the defence. I think they were slightly fortunate in Red Bull definitely had an off day.
Had chances.
Yeah, chances. I'm thinking particularly of, I think it was Marcel Sabitzer.
Oh, that Sabitzer chance.
Had a massive chance. They've got relatively fortunate there. Slight doubts looking forward ahead. Obviously, Marco Reus out injured. I thought Gertz was quiet up front. Jadon Sancho had one of his more quieter games. And when the big moment came and Maximilian Philipp's going through one-on-one, all right, yeah, credit to Peter Gulacsi getting a foot on that and tipping it wide. But that's that's precisely the sort of finish that you need your backup striker to take in. Yeah. And that makes the points absolutely secure. Happy days, everyone can relax. So, yeah, maybe it's looking ahead. They're still in the Cup, still in the Champions League. They're going to have to start rotating a bit. So they're going to need... second string players of the likes of Phillips to come in and be
they
taking those
Weigl
chances.
Might need Weigl in defence, might need Weigl up front.
Yeah. I would say about Götze though, like I think that's interesting. You thought he was quiet. I thought he was actually better than he has been. I thought he's been on like a gradual increase in terms of, obviously you don't want to weight him still on this 2014 comparison, which I think is unfair. But I think his body language seems much more positive. His
he has been much better this season. The first half of the season, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right to point out he's definitely one of the highlights of watching Dortmund. But the way that particular game against Red Bull developed, I thought you needed a more pacey player up front. You needed to see more from Sancho, which we didn't.
Yeah.
And again, I go back to the chance that Philip had. It was on the break on the last man, and that's precisely not Mario Götze's game. So from that point of view, I can understand. I can give him a little bit of leeway there and say
this team is also rather dependent on Marco Reus. One thing I noticed was that you saw players like Rafael Guerrero trying to take more upon himself, considering that Reus wasn't there to combine with. It doesn't seem like they're going to be without him very long. He said recently that he expects to be back for the Hannover game. I mean, it was the injury did come in the training before, before the game, and he did still travel. So it was, I mean, if it was more serious, he might have not even traveled to Leipzig. So, but it is somewhat striking that they are still so dependent on Marco Reus to do things. And
I think that's going to change over the time, though. I mean, he's such an important figure. We've talked about him. He had that famous quote this week where he told the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung that he was like, I'll never go to Bayern, you know, and totally identify with the club. And obviously, you know, that's the kind of quote that makes headlines and gets in social media. But if you know Marco Reus, you've known for years that he has been a part of this club and he was never going to go to Bayern. I mean, you can see it on the way that he is on the pitch, the respect that he commands from his teammates. There's obviously been something different about him this year when he wearing the armband, playing for Dortmund, being in the form of his life. I think the main thing is that he's just not been injured. And, you know, he's been able to play pretty much all the way straight through, including the summer. And that's been huge for him. You know, think about all of the tournaments and the games that he's missed. It must be really, you know, such a great feeling for him to do that and to play all of those games. And I think that's rubbing off in his confidence. And because he's such a brilliant player when he's confident and healthy, look at the way he played against Bayern in the Clásico. It was just an incredible performance. Because of all of those things, that rubs off on other people, right? And, you know, Jadon Sancho doesn't need any invitation to be a bit more flary on the pitch to show that kind of swagger and skill. And the same goes for someone like Mario Götze, who's basically Marco Reus's best friend. You know, so you've got all of these, you know, interrelationships that are riding high on confidence. And I thought it was interesting that even without Reus, they were still able to tap into some of that. I mean, Sancho wasn't that great, but you saw some sort of limit of his game, but he did have a couple of moments where you're like, that's why he's in the team. Guerrero is a little bit more one-dimensional, but his delivery can be really good. There were phases, you know, where Dortmund were right, and I think they did enough. And that's the big thing. They've done enough in so many other games in the past, like Matt said, where they've done enough and then they get a last-minute goal that they lose. I remember that game in Leipzig when they first played each other. Mm-hmm. I think it was Burke who set up Keita?
Yes, yeah.
It was Naby Keita's
goal. Yeah, in the last minute, right? And then a heartbreaking performance. But that was also one of those games where you sort of think, like, oh, Dortmund did enough to get something. And here we are. And you're absolutely right, Matt. You know, this is the kind of game that if Dortmund win the title, it'll be like, that was a key moment because we didn't just draw.
I also think looking at the more sort of general long-term development of Borussia Dortmund, going back all the way back to the Monaco game and the bus attack. Mm. Hans-Joachim Watzke's got a big interview, a very critical interview actually in El Freunde this month, which he talks about and he makes absolutely no bones of, I think he's right to do so, to point out the absolutely immense effect that had on the whole club. Yeah. It meant that, it led not just to Tuchel's departure, but to half of the coaching staff and playing staff as well. It meant that Peter Bosz, for all his mistakes, was off to an absolutely non-starter. He was never going to succeed there. It took the stabilising effect of a quite uninspirational Peter Stöger to come in. That club has been through so much. And it's precisely that sort of psychological state of mind which probably led to last minute lapses like the first game in that they had in Leipzig, just because that's the example we had off the top of our heads then. But the change in that state of mind is then what's now led to them being able to hang on in a game like that.
If you look at it, Dortmund have almost no players in the team now that were there then.
Yeah.
And there's obviously some deliberateness to that, because, you know, you're looking to make a decision to move the club forward because it is such an emotional weight. It's not something that you just get over 3 months later. So, you know, I have to say, hats off to the way that Vasco is... Not initially, obviously, there's some criticism or room for criticism there. But in terms of, you know, Dortmund could still now be losing games 1-0, struggling, suffering under the weight and not living up to the expectation. But they have, in a very short period of time, got the right head coach in, got the right atmosphere, changed enough of the players and the situation that they can move forward without being affected by the past.
So let's move on to Leipzig, because this was their first loss to start a Rückrunde since they were promoted 2 years ago. They are still missing some players in their squad. They're missing Emil Forsberg. There was a piece in Kicker talking about how much Emil Forsberg's creativity is missed in that team. But it also seems, Ralf Jannik is also just trying things that aren't really working right at the moment, too, because he started the game with a 4-3-3, putting Werner on the left. He did that also against Bayern Munich, too, to try to take advantage of how high Joshua Kimmich is playing. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to be working, and it seems like when they revert back to the identity that they've had, which is a 4-2-2-2 that's very attacking, that seems to be working better. So what did you make of it's not like they played bad either. They outshot Dortmund in the game 12-8, and they had 5 shots on target, and some of this if Robin Berkey didn't make some of the incredible saves that he did.
Yeah.
I mean, this could have easily been a draw for them.
Or even a win, you know. I think we just talked about stabilizing factors at Dortmund. On the flip side, I think Leipzig are very unstable. This is an interim year. We've talked about the fact that Nagelsmann's coming. But I also think that Timo Werner's future is unsettling for the club. And if you look at all the individual cases, I mean, you've got Jean-Kevin Augustin, who's a very talented player who's hardly getting any game time. You've got lots of players. They had issues in the Europa League with 2 players that were dropped because of their use of their mobiles. There seems to be a little bit of discontent in between players and management.
They've already had six months of Naby Keita poaching the same problems off the pitch. The Emil Forsberg rumours, I think initially it was AC Milan. They've been persisting for almost 12 months now.
It's not easy. It's not easy to...
I don't think it is easy at all. And I'd add all to that the fact that obviously Ranić knows that he's only in that particular position for a year. I think they're also caught a little bit between a rock and a hard place, in that we saw in the second half of their first season, quite infamously now, how teams, for want of a better word, start to find them out a little bit.
Yep.
They say, okay, you have the ball. We know you're great pressing us. We know that when you win the ball, you can transition quickly and really
hurt
us.
What can you do with the ball?
What can you do with it?
Yeah.
And yeah, teams did, find them out a little bit. And I do wonder if Ranić, especially when it comes to the games against the bigger teams, so against Dortmund, we saw, like you said, lined up in more of a 4-3-3. When they do have the ball and when the onus is on them at home against a theoretically weakened Dortmund side and the pressure's on them to perform in front of their own fans, are they used to it? And he said, they do look more of at home in that 4-2-2-2. But Lucien Favre will have seen that coming. I think Dortmund will have been more than happy to let them have the ball and say, well, come on. And that would have posed Red Bull exactly the same question. So I do wonder, given all those issues, that the managerial transition, unrest within the squad, a few injury concerns, and this sort of tactical state of being in between, I think there's 4 issues there.
Well, you also wondered too. I mean, you mentioned also Timo Werner as well. I mean, these are players that 2 years ago, Naby Keita, Emil Forsberg, Timo Werner, they were the 3 players that needed to be on the field, or else Leipzig weren't Leipzig. What happens now if next year all 3 of them are gone?
Well, look at Willy Orban. Willy Orban's supposed to be the captain. He was on the bench for this game.
Yeah.
You know, I know that Konate and Upamecano have been playing really well, but if you're going to move away from your captain, and everybody talking about Ralf Fährmann being dropped by Schalke, you know, I know that this is not the first time that Willy Orban hasn't played, but you know, he's supposed to be the captain, he's supposed to be the leader of this team. You're not even playing him. You know, I do wonder whether Raniak being there for only a year is undermining his authority in that situation. I know he's always been the boss, and whoever comes in, you know, when Nagelsmann comes in, he'll still be the boss because it's Ralf Raniak's baby, basically, this club. But it can't be doing him any favours right now, because this quote about, well, I don't know whether it was Werner or Raniak, I can't remember, it was someone who said, or whether it was Mintzlaff, who's, well, if Bayern, if they're ernst, if they're serious, there's not much we can do about Werner and the offer for Werner.
That combined with Werner's quote that, oh, well, if I'm going to go anywhere, then it's probably only Bayern. Well,
yeah,
well,
yeah, but
it's a combination of two. It's, you know, we're not even just talking about, you know, light flirting. This is heavy petting in terms of the way that you're going about who you want to join, you know. And I think that that's probably pretty unsettling for everyone else in the club. Jean-Kevin Augustin is probably like, please go so I can play. But, you know, Timo Werner is absolutely the most important player in that team now that Naby Keita isn't there. I mean, Ebel Forsberg, yes, important, good, but not as good as he has been, or he was, a couple of years ago. And the same for Yusuf Poulsen. Poulsen hasn't been as good. He just hasn't been as good. So he has his moments, for sure, but I feel like Timo Werner at the moment is by far and away the most important player in that team. And if he goes, you can ask the question, who's going to score the goals in that team?
I almost feel like the whole direction of the club is sort of performing at, not quite at full throttle at the moment. I think if you look at the bigger context of a lot of Bundesliga clubs and the way they operate, especially in terms of buying and selling players, I'd say the majority, apart from Bayern to an extent, Dortmund, they all know they're selling clubs and they all know they've got a position lower down the food chain. Dortmund probably to a slight extent starting to change that a little bit, but even they're in a position where there's certainly prices for certain players where they cannot say no. And they have to rely on other factors to keep players. And again, just the Dortmund example would be like, what else can we offer you where we can offer you to play in front of the highest average attendances in Europe? I would have assumed at the very start of the whole project that the unique factor that Red Bull could offer players would be, come and play for us where you have an unlimited budget, an unlimited supply of technical and scientific expertise. We're going to be absolutely on the cutting edge. There's absolutely no financial boundaries to establishing us as the top, or at least a top two team in Germany and Champions League week in, week out. But if they're not performing that, then what point is there being apart from seeing it as purely a stepping stone? And that's when you see the issues that Keita had, that Forsberg had, that Werner had. And that will only continue while they're not pursuing their own USP absolutely to the 100% of their ability, which I don't think they are at the moment.
And the interesting thing about Werner to Bayern is, you know, that even that rumour or the suggestion of that is, I struggle to see him anywhere in that team, right? I mean, you've got Sandro Wagner as the backup, right? And the way that they play is very codependent on one striker that is like Lewandowski, hold the ball up, very strong. I don't think Timo Werner is that. Timo Werner, more recently as well for Germany, has played very successfully on the wing, right? Bayern love wingers that can do that, but Timo Werner is not Kingsley Coman. So Timo Werner is not going to be a winger that Bayern want, aka a winger that can win one-on-one situations. So I don't really see where Timo Werner fits in that team,
especially because we don't, and we'll probably get onto this in the second part of the pod, but we also don't know at this stage what exactly Bayern Munich are going to look like in 12 months from now.
And that's my concern about this whole rumour. I can actually see him in a Dortmund team.
I was just about to say, ironically, he's more suited tactically to line up in yellow.
far more, because Dortmund don't play with this sort of bullish one-man striker. That's why Götze or Alcacer or Reus have played in that position before, because he's so fluid with a front four. A bit like Germany were 4 years ago when Götze and the false nine actually worked, you know, when Klose came off, because that's kind of what Klose is. Klose was really good at that as he got older. He would sit a little deeper and be involved in the attack and always be in the right position to score. And Götze was good at that 4 or 5 years ago because he was quicker than most players in that position. And now Dortmund have the same setup. I mean, when Alcacer is injured, I mean, they didn't have Alcacer. Everyone was like, who's going to play up front? Because they just played Götze up there. Sometimes they played Reus. They didn't really have anyone. They even tried that a few years ago with Adrian Ramos, who, if we're honest, is like a poor man's version of Lewandowski, because he's just, you know, given the ball, he's good in the air. He's got that ability to hold it up. But he's not the right striker for the way that Dortmund play. And that's why I think the whole Werner thing is even more confusing, because I'm sure that we're not the only ones who think that, because I don't know where he fits at Bayern. He obviously fits at Dortmund really well, but he's probably not going to go there because, you know, it looks like he's already said there's only one club I'd go to in Germany. He could go to a whole host of teams in the Premier League, but he doesn't strike me as the type of player that wants to leave Germany yet. So
The whole assumptions from both sides. The assumption from Werner and his team, the assumption from those in control at Red Bull, and also the assumption from a lot of the media and a lot of supporters that Bayern would be his ideal destination. I think that's a little bit bizarre. That it's all assuming that a paradigm that existed 2 years ago in the Bayern style of play and attractivity. Would be enough to make that an absolutely no-brainer, and it's not even worth discussing. That's going to happen. We just accept it. Like John said, I don't think it is. It's not nailed on at all that he would fit in whatever constellation Bayern can
be in. Imagine how good he'd be in a Dortmund team.
Unbelievable. He wouldn't have missed that chance that Maximilian Philipp makes.
Exactly.
I'm not just hating on Max Philipp. I think he's a good player, but
don't think he's Dortmund level though.
I don't think he's Dortmund level. I think that's it's obvious. That's why he was one of the names mentioned over winter, that if there are going to be any departures from Dortmund,
it'd be Max Philipp.
It probably would be.
He'd be great at a club like Hoffenheim. Do you know what I mean? He score goals, be fit in that team. Super. It's the same type of style. No problem. But expectation. It's also tough. He's not played any football, right? But in those games, Matt's right. You know, you need someone who's just going to turn to and be like, he's going to score there. Because if it's 0-0, and that's the biggest chance of the game, and you don't score that, you're like, ugh.
So much depends on what Bayern look like. And
absolutely.
Are Bayern going to be able to modernise and bring themselves into... can they respond to the challenge that Dortmund are posing them? And not just Dortmund, but long-term RB as well.
Well, let's get into Bayern Munich, because they did put pressure on Borussia Dortmund this weekend. They beat Hoffenheim 3-1 on Friday night.
We also watched that game together.
We also watched that game together, Jonathan. It was interesting because they it's the first one of the first teams that I've seen in a long time in the Bundesliga that is really taking advantage of how wide Hoffenheim play, and to the point that Julian Nagelsmann had to put Kevin Vogt in midfield in order to make it more compact, because the amount of space that Leon Goretzka, who scored two goals in the game, the amount of space that he had in midfield was a lot.
Yeah.
So what did you make of Bayern Munich's performance? Because they were consistent in the first half, but they really took advantage of this Hoffenheim team this time.
Yeah, they did. And Niko Kovac said it. He said afterwards that the first half was sensational. It was the standard that we expect from this Bayern Munich team. You know, and that's given all of the problems that Bayern Munich had in the first 6 months of this season, all of the issues around Kovac, everything with Hoeneß, to come out in the first game of 2019 and play that well, pretty impressive. Because people were hating on Kovac, people were saying this team was done, this team was old, and we were all saying that. It's funny, you know, there's so many different narratives that have gone through this season. Four games into the year, Matt and I going, oh, here we go again, same old Bayern, same old Bundesliga. Then he has this catastrophe of confidence in the team, just disappears and loses and draws, and Dusseldorf get a result in Munich, and you're thinking the world's going to end. And then they come out after the winter break, and I was not expecting Bayern to play this well, but it does bode very, very, you know, it bodes well for the rest of the season, because it means that the two teams at the top of the table are really going to be going at it. And that's really exciting, because the Bundesliga hasn't had that, and I think it's really, really close. Bayern were the best I think I've seen them all season, maybe since the opening day or the second day, maybe since the opening day when they played Hoffenheim last time, and they got a bit fortunate with the decisions then. But Leon Goretzka was played in the 10. Great decision.
Right.
He even said after the game, sort of hinting to Kovac, the manager knows that I enjoyed playing there and I had fun. And it was obvious because
I'll play back there, but I really enjoyed playing
in
the 10.
I love playing in this position. And it would be a terrible waste, because this is a team that doesn't really know what to do with James Rodriguez, who can be a great playmaker, is very reliant on Thiago in many situations. And if Thiago doesn't play well, Bayern don't play well. And here we have Leon Goretzka, who basically has been hiding in midfield in a holding position for so long and being forced out wide for Germany. Nobody knows what they want to do with this guy.
I think he played even as a fullback at one point.
Yeah, exactly. And at some point, left back. And you think, like, why does nobody know how to get the best out of this player? It's obvious that he's very, very good in these are his attributes. He's got great playmaking ability. He can score goals. He can set things up. And he's got great drive. He did all of those things in Zinn Time on Friday night. And it was the reason that Bayern Munich won the game. They should have been, 3 or 4-0 up. But the fact that he played so well, I think, bodes very well for the second half of the season for them. Because if they can get the best out of players like that who haven't played well so far, I mean, I'm excited. I'm really excited because Bayern Munich look like they've come to play. Niko Kovac deserves an awful lot of credit because he's had to weather all of that storm, and some of it was not justified in terms of, you know, headlines about how good he was and whether he was qualified at the job. This is the first time he's done this at this level, right? You've got to remember that. It's the first time he's gone through intense media coverage, expectation, the expectation to not just win but be excellent every week, and he's dealt with it. You could argue extremely well, come through it, winter break, and they smash Hoffenheim in the first game.
Yeah, I think Matt, that was an important point, is that this was the first game after the winter break. Were you encouraged by the fact that after a four-month break, that, I mean, this is the performance that we saw from Bayern Munich?
I think the month away probably would have helped if they had the training camp in Qatar, didn't they? Which, yeah, for all the ideological and moral issues that people might have with that,
and with Frank Ribery's golden steak that he ate.
Yeah, well, I mean, whether that's an ideological problem, moral problem, or just purely a media problem, I mean, who cares? I think you can't. Obviously, it's understandable that having that week or so away with the players it was always going to give Kovac the opportunity to establish his authority and really get into the team, and without having the day-to-day distractions of life as a Bayern Munich player in Germany. So I think, yeah, I'm not overly surprised that they've come back and performed the way they have from there. I think as much as I agree with you, everything that John was saying, one player I haven't mentioned is Javi Martinez, who I thought was outstanding in front of the back four.
Yeah, he definitely adds a very different element to that midfield, because you don't have Leon Goretzka and Thiago having to track back. But having someone there in front of the defense really, really helps.
And it left Goretzka free to go forward. What also helped was how offensively Hoffenheim was set up, and I think Julian Nagelsmann was a little bit overconfident, but I think he overplayed it a little bit. Looking at even just the fullbacks in Kaderabek and Schultz, relatively attacking fullbacks, I'd say Kevin Demirbay, in a holding midfield position, also not a completely defensive player, quite creative going forward too.
I think more than the fullbacks, because I mean Schultz and Kaderabek have been playing those roles for, I mean, they have been playing for Flores for a long time,
they were pushed so far up, and Demirbay also not the most disciplined player in there. Yeah. It wasn't just that Goretzka and Thiago had the safety of the knowledge that they were safe with Javi Martinez behind them. They're also safe in the knowledge that there's absolutely no Hoffenheim holding midfielder or even sort of like a Doppelzex double six there in front of the back four. They have pretty much free reign to do whatever they like. So on the one hand, I think, yeah, fair play to Julian Nagelsmann for absolutely going for it, and Schultz scored a fantastic goal. The goal itself was fantastic, but Joe Linton tracking back and starting off that counter-attack.
Two goals scored from attacking corners. Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it?
It shows how much space there was in midfield for both teams to break through it. I thought the goal that Hoffenheim scored was probably exactly nailed on textbook how Nagelsmann wanted to play.
Yeah, I bet they practiced that in training.
Yeah, Joe Linton tracking back, starting off, and then Bittencourt with the quick thinking to play it to play in Schultz, who made up loads of ground to get up there. But it was only possible, and like you said, the Bayern goal as well, they were only possible because there was so little going on in the middle of the park. And I think that ultimately, ultimately cost them.
Yeah. So you mentioned this earlier, Matt, but Serge Gnabry didn't play in this game. Thomas Müller was on the right again. You have the issue of, Goretzka did play well as the 10, but they do, Bayern Munich have two other 10s, James Rodriguez and Thomas Müller, that also need to play.
I'd have dropped Müller for Gnabry.
Yeah?
And I would have played Gnabry. I mean, if you're talking about ideal starting 11, I'd have played Gnabry instead of Müller.
Well, that's interesting, because on Friday what you told me...
Yeah, I said other than Müller... That was the only change I would have made in that team. So on Friday when we talked about it, and I said, yeah, this is probably the strongest Bayern team available. The only change I would make would be Gnabry for Müller, because I think you need more pace and trickery outside. But funnily enough, having said that, Müller set up Lewandowski for the third goal, and he wasn't anywhere near as bad as he was in the first half of the season. So again, it's not because he's, you know, out of sorts with this team. There is still value to the way that Thomas Müller plays in terms of how he could fit into Bayern Munich. But I think if you're talking about best 11, You can interchange Goretzka and Hammers. And if Bayern have the depth, you know, this is Bayern Munich. They need that depth. They're in the Champions League still. They're in the German Cup still. So you have the option of playing either Goretzka or Hammers, depending on who's in form. Keep Goretzka in the 10. Keep Coman out wide and keep Gnabry out wide. Play Lewandowski up front. And then you have Thiago and Martinez holding, because Thiago will basically be your deep-lying playmaker. And then Martinez does all the water carrying. Alaba and Kimmich. And then I would play Hummels and Zule, because Boateng is in probably the lowest bit of form that he's been in a while. And then Neuer, who made an unbelievable save, by the way, at the end of the game. Before Bayern scored their third, I think it was 2-1 at the time. And, you know, for all the criticism I've given him, which I, you know, stand by, because I think he should have been dropped in November. That was a good way to start the second half of the season for a player that was really out of form in the first half of the season.
But as you mentioned, Matt, you said earlier that it depends on what kind of team Bayern wants to be over the next 12 months, or how Bayern Munich evolve over the next 12 months.
Yeah, but I think the very fact that we're discussing whether Müller should have been starting there on the right or not suggests a degree of flexibility that's now possible in that Bayern team, and it gives Kovac a good choice going forward. I think we pointed out earlier how much space, or how wide and how offensively Hoffenheim were lined up, giving Bayern so much space in the centre. So from that point of view, if Kovac has seen that coming, then that actually makes sense to have the likes of Goretzka and Müller starting, because they're going to have a bit more freedom in the middle. If, on the other hand, they come up against teams who are much more solid, packing the centre of the park and forcing Bayern out wide, then the last thing you want is Müller stuck out on the right, pumping in cross after cross after cross, which we've seen on some occasions in the past. I would then expect to see Kovac starting Gnabry ahead of that, because that sort of trickery from him on the right, Coman on the left, or, you know, depends how many games Robert and Ribéry get this season. That's going to be more important. So, yeah, good options for flexibility going
forward.
But
if we're talking about what Bayern are going to look like, okay, so we know that Robin and Ribéry are gone at the end of this season. Where do you buy if you're Bayern Munich? Because obviously there's a lot of pressure on them to spend 100 million on a player, because, you know, everybody thinks you need to do that to join the elite level. And, you know, they haven't. And Lewandowski has said things, and players have said, you know, we need to join, you know, the top level and spend a lot of money. But where do you do that? I mean, we can have a conversation about who. Timo Werner, not one of those players because of the way that they play.
Yeah. Well, I have at the moment, but do you not see a role for Timo Werner in a potential three of Werner, Gnabry, Coman?
Absolutely, for sure. But, you know, Lewandowski's not getting any younger, but he's still very good, obviously. Wagner, I think, is actually a decent backup, because you can always play him in the Augsburg-Bremen games. Like those, you can just, that's not a problem. And he seems like a guy who's content enough to just sit on the bench. So if that's, you're sorted in that position, I'm just thinking about who you would go and get and how you would move. Yeah, I think you could get Werner and justify it and say we're going to play Werner on the left wing like he does for Germany. Then we've got Gnabry through the middle and Coman out wide. So, you know, Lewandowski at some point, we're talking a little bit further down the road, is going to click over to 32, 33. You know, he's not going to play forever. So, and this is going to drop off after a while. His phenomenal ability to score 30 goals a season isn't going to hang around. So, where do Bayern Munich, you know, how do they transition going forward? Because I expect Boateng to go. There are going to be some changes. A lot of these players are approaching that stage where you need to have people that can step in as well.
Well, let me go back to Niko Kovac, because I think before the season, or before the break, a lot of these discussions about what Bayern Munich are going to look like in
depends
a year's
on the manager.
Time,
yeah,
it
right.
depends on the coach.
But don't you think that he's staying now? Like, I mean,
well, do we think he's staying now?
I'm not going to jump to a conclusion after one game.
Yeah. We all know he's there for the year.
Even if Bayern, even if they don't win the league this year, they're going to be judged on progress in the Champions League.
Yes.
Although I think he's probably got the hardest draw possible in getting Liverpool. That's a huge test for them. If he manages to get them past that, that's absolutely huge. But I worry big time, especially given Joshua Kimmich's positioning, even against Hoffenheim.
Yeah,
he's once again getting caught so far out of the pitch. He's a fantastic player, Joshua Kimmich. No one's denying that, but I've had doubts over his positioning for at least a year now.
And the problem is he rarely gets caught out, because the teams he plays for, Germany and Bayern, are always in the ascendancy normally. But you saw it in Russia. I mean, he was out of position so often.
Sort of Friday night as well. Apart from the goal, there were a couple of counter-attacking opportunities that Hoffenheim had where I didn't watch all the game. I was keeping an eye on the first half. But where even I just glancing at it, caught Kimmich stranded up on the edge of the Hoffenheim box while Hoffenheim were in possession.
Well, can Kimmich succeed in a Kovac team in midfield, though?
Yeah, no, I don't like it. I don't want to play it. No, I don't, because it's a waste of it. Have you ever seen... I mean, his delivery from right back is not even probably. It is the best in the league. Yeah. His crossing is unbelievable.
He has the potential to be one of the best fullback, or to be the best fullback in Europe if he just...
Exactly. If he can get his positioning right.
Disciplines his positioning, goes forward when he needs to, knows when to get back, knows when not to get forward, knows when the right time to put a crossing is, when the right time is just to turn back and recycle possession.
Well, I'm just asking the question because we were talking about what this team should look like. Yeah. I mean, where he plays is
at fullback for me, but
yeah,
it's still fullback.
Bayern Munich won, I think, 4 games in a row with him, or maybe 3 of the 4 games that they won in December with him playing in midfield.
Yeah, I just think he's too slow in possession. I've seen him when he plays for Germany as well. He's I think he hesitates too much. He hasn't got the positional experience.
He's always played the ball slowly. He's
very hesitant.
I know he hates the comparison to Philipp Lahm, and he's right to distance himself from them. Completely
yeah,
right. But even Philipp Lahm only moved into midfield later on in his career.
Exactly. And even then, it was Löw doing his best to imitate Pep unnecessarily, because if you remember, he realized after doing it in the World Cup, he realized having done the experiment that it didn't make any sense and he should move him back to right back. So, I mean, it was also because of injuries, but that's another conversation. The thing about Bayern going forward is it's right to say, how will they look in 2020, 2021? Will Kovac be around? I think a lot of it will depend on how they finish this season. The question is, how much success does he need to stay on? I mean, if they win the German Cup, get to the semi-finals of the Champions League and finish second in the league, is that enough? Bayern standards, obviously not, because they just want to win everything all the time. But I imagine somewhere in some very private room, conversation is being had about how, and maybe I'm wrong, but I can only imagine Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and Uli Hoeneß saying, you know what, it might not be the worst thing for the image of the Bundesliga if we didn't win the league this year. Because if they do, and I know that these guys are uber competitive and want to win everything all the time, and I'm probably way off, but, you know, they tried and tested the Super League thing by dropping it in the atmosphere, and everybody just responded like a Bunsen burner, and it went on, you know, it was on fire, and everyone said no. Bayern Munich, no, they can't do that. Maybe it will happen one day, but, you know, I'll be dead and not interested in football, so it won't matter. But the point is, in knowing that the Super League isn't an option, you know you've got to stay in the Bundesliga. You know you've got to make it attractive. And if you keep winning the league every year, you know that that isn't attractive. So if your focus is Europe, and you're like, you know what? They're obviously going to play to win. I'm not suggesting Bayern Munich are not playing to win. Obviously not. But I don't think they'd be too upset if they finish second in the league.
I'd love to see you pose that question to Uli Hoeneß. He'd accuse you of fake news.
A lot more things to Uli Hoeneß than that, to be honest. Some more pressing issues. How's your tax bill, mate? I think if they finish second in the league, they'd say, yeah, we're obviously disappointed that we didn't win the title. But then the follow-up question is, what else did they do? If Kovac gets them past Liverpool, he deserves huge bonus points for that, because Liverpool are devastating going forward at the moment. If he wins them the German Cup, right, just on top of that, you can be like, I won us some silverware. All right, I kept us competitive. I weathered the storm. I'm weathering a transition from two of the greatest players in the club's history this summer, by the way, which he finally decided to make the move on after like 3 years of dilly-dallying. And in the Champions League, which is, you know, an ever more elite competition every single year, I kept us competitive and I beat one of the best teams in Europe, who were the finalists last year. I think he's got enough there to say, he should have enough there to say, I'm moving the club in the right direction. Let's buy these two or three players, just two or three. We don't need to buy six, two or three absolutely world-class players. By the way, Lucas Hernandez is not one of them. They don't need a left back, like, or a wing back. I just 70 yeah. minute. This was silly, but buy those players and then move forward. I think it's enough. But
I think in terms of
I don't know.
In terms of moving forward, they've got the both from a buy-in point of view, the boost today in one key personnel area that Sven Mislintat is obviously leaving Arsenal.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
A man who Bayern wanted before he left Borussia Dortmund. We've talked before about how impressed we've all been with how Borussia Dortmund's hierarchy recognised their own strengths and weaknesses, and where Vatska and Zorc could afford to start taking steps back whilst restructuring the new Sebastian members of the hierarchy that come in beneath them. The question still remains: can Bayern Munich do that? Can Hoeneß, can Rummenigge do that? And if they can, they'll be on the phone to Miss Lintat right now and saying, right, you're coming in and we're going to give you the remit and the responsibility and the
power. Technical director role that kind of Michael Reschke had, right?
Yeah, but also
exactly. But that's the role that Miss Lintat wants. That's the reason why he's so happy at Arsenal. If Bayern can do that and he can work well with Kovac, then that would be a fantastic first step and the first bit of evidence that we've seen from Bayern Munich that they're ready to start going about the transition and setting themselves up in the future, regardless of what actually happens on the pitch this year.
And getting their house in order, basically, you know. And the extension of that is not just Miss Lintat, but it's also Hermann Gerland is running the academy. So it's about listening to him, giving him the opportunity Bayern haven't had a player out of that academy since Alaba, right? Yeah. So it's about time that they got a player out of there. So, but it's also about listening. So yeah, 70 million on a player, whatever.
It's a small thing too, but Bayern Munich's team is first in the regional league. Yeah. They've wanted to get up back into the third division for a while, but I think that they haven't really they haven't committed tons of resources to it, but they would definitely benefit from being back in the third division.
Yeah, I mean, look at these young players.
Was it Nicholas Dorsch, is it, who played a couple of first team games?
Patrick Vierald, for example, now he's a second division player. You've got Frank Avina, who's just gone on loan to the second division. There are so many players in that reserve team or the youth team that are close to making the jump, right? And maybe they deserve an opportunity, maybe they don't. But Bayern have to make strides. They've put a lot of money into this academy, so that's another thing. Get Miss Lintat in for recruitment, yes, but also make sure that the academy players get the chance, because you can't just keep playing Thomas Müller as your homegrown talent. Then you've got to make other transitions about the house. Uli Hoeneß, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, right? They're not going to be around forever. Uli Hoeneß's image is in tatters in my eyes. I don't know how long he can stick around, as much as he keeps saying he's going to stay around forever. You've got Oliver Kahn, who apparently is rumoured to be involved in that process or how he's going to move forward. There's a very, very strong identification in terms of people thinking about that club. One of the greatest goalkeepers of all time, huge member of that team, would be a fresh change. Then you've got Philipp Lahm, who eventually at some point is going to come back and work in this club. I'm convinced of it. So what role is he going to take? Salihamidzic is not the strongest figure. He's doing his best to weather the storm.
Every now and again, he's allowed to do an interview.
He's read his lines. He knows what he has to say. You know, and I think he isn't the best for that situation, but he's been thrown in at the deep end and he's trying to swim. So how are all these positions going to look? Because Niko Kovac's position is going to be way more stable, if you can imagine a future where Oliver Kahn is the president of the club, Philipp Lahm is the CEO or the sporting director or whatever, and you've got people who are very, very stable, not wild, crazy guys who call press conferences about freedom of speech and, you know, citing the German law. If you have all of those positions in order and you make moves like Dortmund have, like Matt just said, you know, Dortmund have been very smart with it.
That's probably the one area where Dortmund have stolen a little bit from March on Bayern Munich. Not in other areas in terms of the quality they have on the pitch, in terms of the budget at their disposal, or in terms of the worldwide powerhouse marketing fame that they have. But in terms of that structure and setting themselves up for the 10, 15 years to come, where football changes so quickly, I think, even looking outside of Germany, the way that Liverpool are slowly becoming set up, the way that Man City have already been set up, the way that Manchester United would probably like to set themselves up.
The way Paris Saint-Germain have set themselves up with Jordan.
Rummenigge and Hoeneß have to recognise that. And like John's listed the names, we're not sat here saying that, you know,
this is going to happen.
Oliver Kahn must be the next president of Bayern Munich, or Philipp Lahm must be the next sporting director or whatever. But the names are there, the talent is there, the identity figures are there, the experience and expertise is there. If Bayern Munich want it, and if Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge have got the balls to stand back and say, we're going to do what's best for this football.
And you know what we're not talking about is also with that, it's also a change, it's of a generation, right? You know, Philipp Lahm is of a younger generation. I'm not saying that generations need to be replaced. You obviously do need experience, but bringing in Sebastian Kehl at Dortmund.
Sebastian Kehl would be the exact equivalent.
Perfect
of what
example.
Could potentially
right?
be at Bayern
He's
Munich.
Just come out of that squad. He understands what it is to coach players or be around, not coach maybe, but be around players of a modern era. Whereas I do sometimes feel that Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, because they are from a football that is so far away from football being played today, that they haven't necessarily been able to understand what that is. It's very easy for me to say that sat here in a studio recording this, but I'm not having been a professional footballer, not being around that environment. But I would say that unless it takes an awful lot of personal development to say the football I played in 1980 is not the football that's played now, and I have to understand how to approach young men now, and that's different.
I think the telltale signs that the two of them, especially Hernes, that are at least subconsciously slowly becoming a bit out of the depth, the telltale signs are there in these partly mental statements that he puts out to the press. Whether it's Rummenigge insisting we're going to have more on Bayern TV, or just simply cutting off Salihamidžić's answers in a press conference, whether it's Hernes going on mad rant about the Constitution, or was it...
actually, it was Rummenigge's rant on the Constitution.
Was it? Okay, yeah. Great.
It was
Hernes who came out of a rant against the Bayern member who had a go at him at the AGM,
Or even only Hernes talking about Juan Bernat, basically going after him individually.
Whether the two of them know it or not, they're telltale signs that subconsciously the two of them have been left behind slightly. And that's okay. They're both of that generation. Okay, Alfie.
And do something about
it. Yeah. I get the impression that Hans-Joachim Watzke has done that. I don't get the impression that's happened just yet at Bayern. But, you know, let's have a look at the next 6 months. On the pitch, it started off well. Mm. So maybe that will encourage them to say that we've got a new generation coming through now.
All right, before we get to, Matt, your stuff, I want to ask one more question. The two top clubs we talked about the most in this podcast are Bayern Munich and Dortmund. How do you see the title race at this point in time? We haven't really gone into a deep discussion about the title race in the first half of the season, but now since it's the second half, at this point in time, how do you, not necessarily who do you think is going to win or whatever, how do you see it playing out?
I see at some point Bayern going top, but I think, and I hope it's not just my heart saying it, it's not because I particularly like Borussia Dortmund, I don't particularly care, but for the sake of the Bundesliga, I think they'll do it, and I hope they do.
I think they definitely have enough to do it.
But I can see Bayern going top in the meantime at some point.
I have a feeling this is going to be one of the most exciting seasons. I mean, it already is. Let's not kill ourselves.
By our standards.
Well, the standards of Bundesliga fans over the last 7 years. This is already shaping up to be one of the most exciting seasons. Dortmund have a 6-point lead. I agree with Matt that I think Bayern are going to take top spot at some point, and I do have a feeling that that's going to happen.
At what point? Before, just curious.
I think that's going to happen before Dortmund play Bayern again. So what's going to happen is, and this is going to make it really exciting, and I'm now just spinning my imagination, that Bayern are going to overtake Dortmund, taking a point advantage of three or fewer, going into that game.
And then Dortmund are going to win.
Bayern are going to be so knocked back by that, because they're also going to be distracted because they're going to be in the Champions League quarterfinals. And they're going to be thinking, oh no, we've just lost this game. It's going to be tight. I think it's going to come down to the last two or three match days. And I think Dortmund are going to pip it.
It's interesting that you say that, because they have a trip to Gladbach. They already did their trip. No, they haven't done the trip to Gladbach yet. So
no, they, what is it? They finish at Dusseldorf and then...
They have to go to Gladbach on the last day.
So. But Bayern play who on the last day? Who did they play
Stuttgart's next week.
We'll have a look at that. Matt, you find out. I'll talk.
Interesting because...
But that would be interesting, right? Because I can totally see...
I don't know if Bayern Munich is going to get to... I mean, 6 points, I think...
We just talked about Dortmund being very frail about without Marco Reus. If Marco Reus misses a few games, Dortmund don't fire...
We're assuming that he will.
No, I know, but we're just pontificating.
I think Bayern are Frankfurt at home.
Ooh.
That makes it interesting.
That makes it interesting, because at that stage, who knows what Frankfurt are playing for and how red hot those front three still are.
So does this title race come down to the last day?
No, I think...
Yeah, bring it on.
It'd be amazing if it did.
I don't think it will.
I think we're going to get two or three games out from the final match day, and it's going to be clear. I think we're going to get to a situation where something like 3 or 4 games to go, Dortmund are 6 points clear and they win one game and they've done the title.
Yeah, I think it could come down the last day, but it'll be like basically they'll just need a draw to get.
It won't be a dramatic.
What is that? A two point lead at the end of the season?
So Dortmund will need a draw, because if Bayern win, they'll need to score 14
goals, or they'll be like three points ahead Bayern will,
In any case, isn't it exciting that we're having this conversation in January about a Bundesliga title race, and that it could go either way, and we're not just sat here saying Bayern are 15 points clear. How good are Augsburg?
Yeah, well, touch wood. I'm not getting carried away.
So a quick programming note before we get to Matt Ford's piece from Leverkusen. The Tribune podcast will be recording away from home for the first time. We're looking to plan a trip to Freiburg at the end of February, Freiburg's game against Augsburg specifically. So if any of you are in the area at that time, be sure to reach out to us because we're trying to do a bit of a pod spectacular. So just look out for that and we'll keep you posted as things develop. So Matt Ford was in Leverkusen this week. He spoke to some Leverkusen fans about their new coach, Peter Bosch, and caught up with Matt Marshall from Football Grad. Take a listen.
It's Saturday afternoon in a beautiful, sunny Leverkusen. I'm outside the Bayer Arena before Bayer Leverkusen against Borussia Mönchengladbach. I'm lucky enough to have a few Leverkusen fans here with me who are happy to answer a few questions for the podcast. I've got Ralf, I've got Thomas, I've got Björn, and I've got, Christian. Lads, the second half of the season is starting today, but looking back to the first half of the season, it was quite difficult, I think, for Bayer Leverkusen, and in the end Heiko Herrlich lost his job. So starting with you, Ralf, question number one, do you think it was the correct decision to sack Herrlich? And question two, do you think it was the correct decision to appoint Peter Bosch?
Well, I think it was the right decision to change the trainer because they lost too many simple games. Mm-hmm. We could have had a few points more if the team would have played more concentrated. And so the change was necessary. They often played very, very bad. And the point or the time to change the trainer was the wrong time because the last three games we won, but the way they played was too bad, and so I think
what particularly was bad? Do you think was it too offensive or was the defense not strong enough?
Everything, too many chances, 100% chances without a goal. Mm-hmm. The defense often slept during the game, and suddenly they made the game, and suddenly we have been behind. So I think something was wrong with the team or in the relation team to trainer. Yes. If Peter Bosch is the right decision, I can't say.
He's a very attacking coach, isn't he? A very offensive coach.
He started very successfully in Dortmund. Yes. And I think the problems he had there was not a problem of him, but the team. Mm-hmm. Dortmund had a lot of queens during the time he was there. Yeah. And so it was very difficult for a trainer to catch Aubameyang, for example.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. Thomas, sticking with Peter Bosch, other names that were mentioned, I think Ralf Hasenhüttl was mentioned, I think Marco Rose was mentioned. What's your opinion on Peter Bosch?
I'm not really satisfied with the decision to have Peter Bosch as the new coach. I think it was the wrong time to let down Heiko Herrlich because in the end he had three matches he won. I don't think that we would have had success on the going that we... But I don't think it was right to sack Heiko Herrlich and then to get Peter Bosch. So I'm not really familiar with Bosch.
He's like Ralf said, he started really, really well at Borussia Dortmund. Yeah. And because obviously he's got such an offensive style of play, do you not think that is a good fit for Leverkusen with so many offensive players?
We have many offensive players, but I don't think Heiko Herrlich was a defensive coach. And Peter Bosch is not... And it's not better than Heiko Herrlich, I think. So I'm not really satisfied with the decision, with the change itself. It's okay that we sacked Heiko Herrlich. It's the time was not okay. It was okay to get a new coach, but I can't see any advantage of Bosch.
Okay, so yeah, Thomas, you're not particularly convinced by the appointment. Björn, let's move on and just talk a bit about some of the players that Leverkusen have. Because I think, I always say, on paper at least, it's one of the most impressive squads in the Bundesliga. When you look at Kevin Volland, Bellarabi, Havertz, Brandt, Bailey, the list goes on and on. Which players disappointed you last season, and which players are you maybe expecting more from in 2019?
I'm very disappointed of Julian Brandt, for example. This is a very young player who's playing a very good football usually, but I think this season, I don't know if it's maybe the motivation or something like that. Yeah, I think we have many talents, but they don't really show what they are able to show usually. And maybe this is some problem that Herrlich had, so that he couldn't let the players show what they are able to show.
Yeah. Like I said to Thomas, lots of very attacking players. Do you think that'll be a good fit between with a coach like Peter Bosz, who, as we saw in Dortmund and at Ajax before that, he plays a very attacking style of football. Is that something you want to see in Leverkusen?
Yeah, of course, as a football fan you want to see this, but I'm a little bit afraid because of our defense. I don't know if they really fit into the system, but I think we have the offensive players for the system, but I'm not really sure about the defense players, so okay. I'm a little bit afraid of today, so I'm not really sure how it's developing.
Yeah. Let's talk about today then. Obviously, Borussia Mönchengladbach finished 2018 in third. Is it fair to say that they had the season that you wanted to have?
Yeah, I think so, but yeah.
They're quite similar teams on paper, aren't they?
Yeah, but I think maybe Borussia Mönchengladbach was also the right team for us because they're very weak outside, and so maybe this is our chance. But
they have got a really bad away record. I think at home they've played 8-1-8, but away from home, they are slightly more vulnerable.
Yeah, so, and also my uncle is a fan of Borussia Mönchengladbach, so I hope that Leverkusen will win today.
So we've got a particular bit of family tension as well. Lads, thank you for your time and enjoy the game. It's full time in Leverkusen. Bayer Leverkusen 0, Borussia Mönchengladbach 1, which means that Peter Bosz's reign as Bayer Leverkusen coach has got off to a losing start here at the start of the Bundesliga Rückrunde. Lots of possession, lots of shots on goal for Bayer Leverkusen, but I couldn't help but think that Gladbach and Dieter Hecking were actually quite happy just to let them have the ball. I'm just on the way back to Cologne now with football journalist Matt Marshall. He's been kind enough to give me a lift as we go past the huge Bayer Cross in the pharmaceutical city. Matt, your immediate thoughts after that game?
Well, Boss selected a really attacking lineup, didn't he? And we saw Havertz and Julian Brandt either side of Arangis. So really interesting to see the balance. But, they dominated the game, as you said. They had possession for most of the game and had a lot of chances. Bellarabi hit the post late, but really unable to create a whole lot of clear-cut opportunities. Bailey was reinstated on the right wing and really struggled to do much against Oscar Wendt. And then we saw once he came off, Bellarabi really came alive on the right-hand side. And Kai Havertz was really brilliant again, especially, in the second half. So it's a really tough one to break down, isn't it? Because, Leverkusen have come away with another defeat. But they actually played quite well. And even the concerns we had before the game, as we said, with just Aaron Giz there as a holding midfielder, he actually did quite well. And they equipped themselves, on the whole, quite well. But we have to also remember that, as you said, once Gladbach took the lead, they weren't really going to press that high and put Leverkusen under that much pressure. So it's really hard to take that much away from this game. But, you'd have to say that they did play quite well despite coming away with nothing.
In the press conference afterwards, then, we're just listening to Dieter Hecking saying that they quite purposely sat back, sat narrow, made sure that the pitch was narrow for Leverkusen, didn't give them space, and pretty much invited them on. They sat there in a pretty solid 4-5-1, weren't they? And did you ever really get the impression that, apart from the Bellarabi shot that hit the post, that Leverkusen, did you feel that a goal was coming?
Well, Havertz had a few opportunities, but as you said, you know, every time they went through the middle there, they just ran into brick wall. And, you know, Gladbach were really comfortable letting them have possession out wide and whip a few crosses in. So, yeah, I thought Hecking did well. You know, he came there here with a pretty good tactical setup. His team were really organised. Tobias Strobel, again, was instrumental in the holding midfield role.
You were raving about Tobias Strobel all through the game. You were really impressed with performance, weren't you?
Oh, he's exceptional, and you have to cut him off. You have to deny him space, and also, you know, Lars Stindl did what Lars Stindl does, and he was very important in the build up to the goal, and that's why I thought that, you know, Peter Bosz was, you know, although he tried a slightly new formation with the 4-3-3, that, you know, one thing you have to do playing Gladbach is lock up Lars Stindl and Tobias Strobel. And they did neither of those things, which was largely down to the formation, as I mentioned to you during the game.
I felt a little bit sorry for Charles Aranguiz in there on his own at times, especially in the build to the goal. He got absolutely nowhere near Lars Stindl. He was left dealing with that situation on his own. Obviously, Stindl did it really well. That's what he does in front of the back four. Great little turn and pass into Hoffmann in the build up, but. Yeah, were Leverkusen therefore not architects of their own downfall by having only one holding midfielder against that sort of attack?
Well, in a way, yeah. And I thought that having one holding midfielder, you know, means that you can't really lock up Lars Stindl, which you need to do against Gladbach. And also, playing the three forwards, you know, there really wasn't anyone able to lock down Tobias Strobel. I think to do that, as I mentioned to you during the game, you need to play a 4-2-3-1. Against Gladbach, which gives you an extra man against Stindl, and also gives you that number 10 guy who can, you know, hassle Strobel and cut off the time on the ball, because he doesn't need hardly any time to get it and then to pick out a pass. So I thought, yeah, that was a letdown for Leverkusen and Boss's tactics today, that the two guys in Gladbach that you really need to shut down, you know, they didn't do it. But as we said, you know, they still dominated the game, and unlucky, you would have to say, not to at least get a draw from that game.
Yeah, I think that's fair, given the amount of possession that they did have by the end of the game. In the press conference also, Peter Bosz was quite keen to point out, I think rightly so, that he has only had 2 weeks to work with this team, that he's still trying to implement his philosophy. But what I thought was quite interesting, he also said that we're going to keep working and it's going to get even more offensive. We're going to keep attacking. In the immediate future, they've got Wolfsburg, who are obviously finished the first half of the season really strongly. Looking even further ahead, the aim for Bosz is still to get Leverkusen back up into at least the Europa League, but more importantly, just European football. How do you see that going forward this season under Bosz? Is he making himself vulnerable by continuing and insisting on attacking?
Well, I just got to say, I wrote them off for top six, you know, under Herrlich. I still don't think they can get into the top six. It's going to be fascinating to see this gung-ho type approach, you know. I can't wait to see what happens with Bosz, but I just have this feeling that, you know, it's not going to be that much different to Heiko Herrlich. The balance isn't really going to be there. And, you know, teams are going to figure it out pretty quickly, especially if he keeps playing with one holding midfielder. I'm not against the one holding midfielder, really, but... in Leverkusen's situation, I think it's a bit of a vulnerability, and other managers are going to figure it out pretty quickly and hit them on the counter. You know, as we said,
it took Gladbach about 30 minutes to figure that out today, didn't it?
Exactly. And once Gladbach figured it out, you saw that they finished the first half really strong, yeah. And they could have easily gone into the break 2-0. You know, and the fact that they didn't really exploit the Leverkusen's weakness on the counter-attack more in the second half was just because they were away from home. And
well, Hoffmann had that chance on the counter-attack in the second half, didn't
exactly.
He?
Exactly.
That was the only one.
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is other teams are going to really hit Leverkusen on the counter-attack. They're going to base their tactics around that, and especially away from home, you know, we might see a different story than what we saw today. But it's going to be fascinating to see if Bosz can take Leverkusen to where they want to go. I can't see them making Europe this season, you know, and which will mean that he's got next season at least to implement his philosophy a little bit better, maybe make a few changes in the transfer market in the off-season. But my initial impression is that, you know, there's not going to be a whole lot of difference between Bosz and Herrlich. It might be a bit more attacking, but they're still going to be wide open on... on the counter-attack, and that could be their downfall, but we'll see what happens, man.
There you go. Well, Matt, thanks for your time. Just looking ahead of that game there, the big choreography in the corner from the away fans, with the Gladbach fans, with a message saying a westerly wind is blowing, and well, they certainly took the wind out of Peter Bosch's sails today on his first game. It finished Leverkusen 0, Borussia Mönchengladbach 1. Thank you for listening.
That was Matt Ford in Leverkusen, and that will do it for this week's edition of the Tribuna Weekly. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, and if you do, please give us a positive review. You can follow Matt Ford on Twitter at Matt_4D, Jonathan Harding at JohnBlog66, 2 G's and 2 6's, and I'm at Davis_Benopter. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.